Hey, Risto here from George Mason University. Today, we have a special podcast that is actually the recording from the 2024 Catherine D. Ennis SIG Scholar Lecture. This is the highest honor, the special interest group for the American Educational Research Association, SIG number 93, which is about physical education, instruction, and learning, awards to the scholars in the field. This year's Scholar Award recipient is Kevin Andrew Richards from the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. The first voice that you're going to hear is from Tom Templin. He is, or was, Kevin's dissertation advisor and his mentor. And you'll hear his voice first. The audio isn't super great in the beginning. There's a hard cut, but we wanted to share this a little bit wider. At the end, also, there was a question and answer session, but it's really hard to hear, so I cut it out. And I guess next time you'll have to come visit us in Denver in 2025. All of our abstracts, 2,000 word abstracts, are due usually at the end of July. And the conference is going to be in Denver, Colorado in the end of April. Thanks. I'll put a link to our website there as well. So if you're looking at getting involved with the special interest group, you can find that information below.
Kathy Ennis was one very special person. This is the 7th anniversary of her passing. She died in April of 2017 after just an unbelievable career in pedagogy. You may know that she started at Wisconsin, then went to Maryland, and then finished her career at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. And she did some marvelous things in curriculum theory. She was well noted for her work in value orientations initially, and then towards the end of her career had some significant NIH funding with Hong Chen, our friend over there, and related to physical activity and science education. And she's just a marvelous person, sensitive, loving, caring. There's been a lot written about her career. She was a terrific mentor to many, not only students, but certainly to her faculty colleagues. And this award is really a fitting tribute to her legacy. And Kevin, you should feel very honored to be one of the Ennis Scholars, and I know you are. There have been 31 previous Ennis Scholars. Some are in the room. Would you stand? Ben, on. UNCG. 24 from the United States, 7 from international universities. Kevin, you're number 32, my friend. And of the 24 from the U.S., that they represent 18 different institutions, some of which have had multiple scholar recipients. So Kathy Ennis was definitely the scholar extraordinaire, and we certainly miss it. Now this guy, Mr. Kevin, we're all very proud of. He is definitely the youngest to have received the SIG Scholar Award. And as you will note in some of the comments from his nominators, it's not without his unbelievable record of achievement that motivated these gentlemen to nominate Kevin for the award. How did I get to know Kevin? Risto asked me to limit this to 7 minutes. I'm going to try. Susan Flynn, who was a colleague at Purdue, said she had met this young guy at a national leadership conference. Where was it? West Virginia?
Estes Park, Colorado.
Estes Park, Colorado. came back and said, I met this kid. He's amazing. He's looking for master's programs. We got to get him. And fortunately, Kevin ended up at Purdue starting his master's degree. And almost immediately, I thought, master's, forget that. We're going all the way. And he was joined soon thereafter with a fellow by a fellow named Michael Hempel. Same thing, master's degree, no way. He's going all the way. We're going to pursue the. They're going to pursue the PhD. So Kevin and Michael were partners in crime during their studies at Purdue, and I couldn't have been prouder of both of them. Kevin, left after he finished his PhD. He did a postdoc at Purdue in our Center for Instructional Excellence, and did a super job there. And then did a part-time gig at Northern Illinois University, and then was motivated to go study down at the University of Alabama with Kurtner Smith and Zelennikov, and had a good experience down there. But it was clear that the University of Illinois was the right place to be to study with Kim, to work with Kim Graber and Amy Woods, and he's had a very successful career at Illinois. And he's only a couple hours away, so that's really nice to be able to meet Kevin periodically at kind of a happy meeting place in between Champaign and Lafayette, Indiana. As you know, Kevin has distinguished himself in his work in teacher socialization that spans work with public school teachers, but also he's done some socialization work on graduate students and their experience during grad school. And he's really of late focused in on social emotional learning as it relates to teaching personal and social responsibility in that framework. If you look at his CV, just a host of topics, but they all center around teaching excellence, effectiveness, and trying to make an impact in school physical education and in children's physical activity. He's got, believe it or not, over 140 peer review publications, 28 book chapters, 6 edited books. He's presented over 140 national and international presentations, and he has garnered over $700,000 in research funds. So he's done fairly well. He has served the profession brilliantly as a journal editor, a reviewer. He has worked with kids in physical activity programs. He worked in 2 programs at Purdue, one called the PALS program, which was a summer physical activity program for local school kids. And then he expanded that into what was called Pete's PALS, which was a program for kids with disabilities. My dog was their mascot. And he's carried that program over at Illinois and working with children with disabilities in Champaign. And he's just done just brilliantly, and I'm so pleased that he's working with Kim and Amy now. I talked about the data already. Here are the individuals who nominated Kevin for the award. I was very curious, who in the hell nominated him? Yeah. You know? And wouldn't you know, it was 2 of the icons in our field. Hal Lawson, who was a previous SIG Scholar awardee, as well as Steve. In fact, Steve was the very first SIG Scholar in 1993, so we've been around for a while. And these gentlemen have had a lot to say about Kevin, and I'll try to whip through these, but basically, they're suggesting that, first Hal Lawson suggested that beyond the work he did and the work that I did, that Kevin has taken this to a whole nother level. And that's really high praise for Hal to say that and to mention what kind of impact Kevin has had in the field. And the interesting thing is that, you know, Kevin has only been in the professoriate for a mere 10 years, which is the bottom criterion for being nominated for this award. So you got it right at the first time you were eligible, which is cool. And Steve had something similar to say in terms of, despite Kevin's youth, he's just so meritorious of this particular award. Meritorious, exceptional, distinctive, high impact, nationally, internationally recognized, a distinguished scholar. And he's done his work, you know, some might say, well, geez, he's been so prolific. What's the quality of his work? As you know, the quality of his work is outstanding. I always kidded Kevin a little bit about it. It's not about getting notches in the belt, remember that? It's about quality work. And he has done really excellent work, and his ideas are brilliant. His approach to research design is excellent. His writing is clear. You know when you get a piece of work from Kevin. And believe it or not, we have co-authored, I think, about a quarter of my publications. So thank you. But his work is great. And we know that this work is going to carry on well into the future. The other thing about Kevin, he has been a very strong supporter of this SAIC, and he has worked in other venues within the profession in terms of Shape America, AFERD. He's contributed to Illinois AFERD. He contributed to Indiana AFERD. He's done a lot. I don't know how we got all this energy, Mom and Dad, but somehow you got the right kid. And just extraordinary in terms of his productivity and the quality of his work. Kevin the person. The thing about Kevin is, despite all his success, he is a very humble guy. He's a sensitive guy, as you'll hear in his speech tonight. He's kind, he's caring, he's compassionate, he's resilient, he's a great friend, and he's someone you can count on. And he's a dog lover. And I think that might be top of my list, Kevin. But anyways, I feel very fortunate to have known Kevin for so many years, to be his mentor, his colleague, and his friend. And it is without a doubt that you have reinforced and honored the legacy of Kathy Innes. So let's congratulate Kevin Richards.
Tonight, I didn't think it would be the very beginning. Risto asked me who I wanted to have introduced me, and I thought I would propose something a little bit different. And I asked that both him and Emily introduce me, which for some reason they didn't like. But this was really special. This was really special. I didn't expect you to be here tonight, and for you to make this trip to be here means a lot to me. So
you're welcome.
Thank you for that introduction. Emily and Risto, I'm sure that the two of you had something to do with this. I love you both, although in very different ways.
Yeah, I must say they were both brilliant in hiding this, but particularly your partner, Emily. She was superb.
It feels strange to be up here in front of this room tonight. I still have memories of my first AERA in 2010. Has it really been 14 years? I was in the second year of the master's program at Purdue University back then. I sat in my hotel bed the night before the conference with a highlighter and staved off anxiety as I tried to work my way through the program book to see what I wanted to attend. The conference was intimidating. It also opened me up to the world of educational research beyond our field and helped me connect with different groups of scholars, colleagues from the U.S. and around the world, who I, outside of the folks who I had been connecting with at AFIRD at the time. Mike Metzler received what was still known then as the SIG Scholar Award. While I don't remember the specifics of his talk, I do remember looking up at him and many of the other recipients who have given this talk over the years with a mixture of admiration and trepidation. Would I ever have the honor to give a speech like that? If so, what could I have to say that would be meaningful? Some of you might be surprised to learn that I'm not going to approach answering that question through discussion of the socialization research, at least not explicitly. If you look for it, you'll probably find social theories and perspectives threaded throughout much of what I have to say. I did think about discussing socialization directly and considering future directions and research questions that our field may pursue. That was, in fact, my default starting point when I was asked to give this speech. In reflecting, however, I realized that presentations like that are not all that new. Dr. Templin, for example, has given speeches on his retirement tour over the last few years, outlining key tenets of the theory while identifying limitations in future directions. I decided that I would challenge myself to say something new, different, and perhaps even provocative. At least new, different, and provocative for me. I'm going to open up, be honest, and share my journey and some lessons I've learned about our field and us as people. My strategy exposes my vulnerability. I can't escape it. But that also means that parts of my talk invoke emotion. I experienced them as I prepared, and now that I am with you, I am aware that more feelings are on their way, such as the way that I am built. I hope that you receive my comments tonight knowing that they are from a place of love, appreciation, and admiration, both for every individual in this room and the larger community of teachers and teacher educators. My conclusions will provide some concrete recommendations and suggestions for both doctoral students and early career scholars, as well as those of us who have reached the point of tenure and are now angling towards more senior faculty roles. I would like to start with an introduction that I hope provides some key framing information. My life has changed a lot since that first AERA, both personally and professionally. There's so much I wish I could tell 2010 Kevin. I began my academic journey as a first-generation college student with no real direction or ambition to go to college in the first place. My main motivation was that I thought college was just what you were supposed to do after high school. This is a testament to my parents, Raymond and Rebecca Richards, who provided my brother Justin and me with the tools and resources we both needed to be successful and see college as a viable option, and to both be first-generation college students. A combination of deep and meaningful mentorship, being in the right place at the right time, striving to always have a kind heart, a willingness to work hard and through difficult things, and a light sprinkling of something that may amount to talent have somehow taken me from there to a position as a tenured faculty member. Praise and accomplishment make me uncomfortable, so I'll deflect the credit the best that I can. I truly believe that I'm a product of the system. My identity and career have been shaped as I've been socialized by people in this room and many others through engagement in professional organizations such as this one. Regardless of attributions, I wish I could tell 2010 Kevin that you will be okay. You have a future ahead of you and you will make it. You will be okay. There's something else that I'd like to tell 2010 Kevin, and this would not be so reassuring. This career path is going to cost you, kid. The road you're on and the path you're choosing, they come with consequences. It's going to be hard and it's going to require sacrifice. These assertions are grounded in my lived experiences. While I have been more open in talking about my mental and emotional health challenges in recent years, I've struggled with anxiety and depression throughout my life. Fear of failure fueled a narrow, work-focused view on life early in my career. I felt the need to find something to give value to the world, something to offer justification for my existence. Like others, I focused my quest for self-worth by investing narrowly and almost exclusively on my work and career. While accumulating professional accolades in the pursuit of justification, I neglected relationships. I fell out of touch with friends and family while working 10 to 12 hour days and spending most weekends in the office. My first marriage officially ended in 2020 after 10 years, but it was over long before that. I was not a good husband. Work came first and took priority. My identity and understanding of the world were connected entirely to my role as an academic. I had no hobbies. I didn't take trips that didn't involve conference travel, and evaluated my self-worth solely in relation to productivity and performance. I was my own worst critic, always judging myself most harshly and expecting more from myself than from others, even more than what others expected from me. I will go on to challenge elements of my own journey, push us to reconsider ourselves in the work, recognize that we are more than the value we bring to our work, and prioritize the advancement of community. I also want to be explicit about this tension, this 800-pound gorilla in the middle of the room. I want to, I would not be here talking with you today if I had not made the decisions I made to prioritize work to the detriment of my personal life. I would not have accomplished some of the key things that I have been able to in my career. This includes some of the things that I am most proud of contributing. I think naming and acknowledging that tension is important because my perspective now comes from a position of tenure and privilege in the academic system. 2 years ago, I'm not sure that I would have been able to be as candid as I am today. I also do not want to sound ungrateful, to criticize the things that have helped me to be successful. On the contrary, I am very grateful for these opportunities and how they have contributed to my early to mid-career success. This experience has helped me to better understand how you can be both appreciative and critical of something at the same time. Focusing on the task at hand, and attending many of these named speeches at conferences over the years, I have always appreciated it when the speaker provides an acknowledgement to the person for whom the lecture was named. It helps us remember, preserve legacy. I have always looked up to the senior scholars in our field, and Kathy Ennis is no exception. All of us stand on the shoulders of those who have come before us. It does not mean that we should feel beholden to their beliefs and traditions. Our world changes. The needs and interests of young people change. How we know to best serve them changes. Our methods, approaches, and skill sets all evolve. We need to evolve and do things differently, do them better, and in justifiably different ways. Priorities shift. Those once on the periphery of our field, such as social and emotional learning development, become more central as our society needs them more. Our ability to do that, however, is inexplicably linked to progress made by the generations of scholars who preceded us, such as foundational to the evolution of science. When I consider what I could playfully call the Mount Rushmore of physical education scholarship, those disciplinary stewards who contributed substantially and uniquely to the growth and development of our field, it is hard not to include Kathy. While I was not fortunate enough to know her well, I did have the opportunity to meet her several times, and I have used her scholarship throughout my career. Her work on value orientations is closely connected to my focus on socialization, for example, and her intervention work with Ong Chen remains a model for our field to follow. Ong, I am positive that Kathy would be so proud of the work that you continue to do with your students at UNCG. To this day, when I teach qualitative research methods, I go to Kathy's work in explaining the importance of theory as a thread that ties together all elements of the research plan. I was honored to be part of the team that helped to rename this award in her honor after her passing. While Kathy had a notable, albeit arm's length, influence on my career and development, I have seen, heard, and read many stories about how she's touched others, how she served as a friend and mentor to many of us. This is perhaps best preserved in the special issue of Kinesiology Review honoring Kathy's career. This special issue discusses her scholarly contributions and then honors her life and legacy with papers written by colleagues and friends. Articles by Jane Clark and Bradley Hatfield, Pamela Kalina, Ong Chen, Steve Silverman, and Melinda Solomon highlight the human side of Kathy. I took an excerpt from Steve's paper, hoping his words could do her more justice than mine. Kathy was a first-rate scholar and professional, and she appropriately used her visibility to promote others in our profession. Over the years, Kathy and I collaborated to nominate other scholars for awards and offices. Kathy was always thoughtful about other roles in helping the profession, about our roles in helping the profession, and was generous about supporting others. She clearly thought about the next generation of scholars and professionals and wanted to make sure they were recognized the way that they deserved. This proactive promotion of others was something that she did year in and year out, and I'm proud that we were able to do this together. It was Steve's words where I found a major source of inspiration for how I decided to answer my initial question. What would I have that is meaningful to say? Building from descriptions of Kathy and my own reflections on being mentored and mentoring others, I found direction. I want to talk about community, about care, and about advocating for one another and seeking a more socially just world. Some of what I have to say will be directed at doctoral students and early career scholars. Other messages will challenge those of us with tenure to actively pursue the types of spaces for which I advocate. In thinking about how Steve described Kathy, I was reminded of something important that I see in the best scholars, those that have had the biggest impact on our field. They are bright, inquisitive, and innovative leaders, no doubt about it. What is perhaps more important, however, is that they follow the creed that disciplinary stewardship puts advancement of the field ahead of their own personal gain. Further, they care not only deeply about the field, but about the people working within it. Mentorship and advancement of scholarly enterprise across generations is central to their legacy. They seek not to create replications of themselves and their students and mentees, but to use their platform to help aspiring scholars find personal satisfaction and self-actualization through their work. This is altruism, and it's a cornerstone of scholarly ethic. This is how we grow. This is how we advance. By equipping future generations with the skill sets to go beyond and do better than what was possible for us. Today is not our ceiling and is also not our floor. It is another important step in the staircase that is our profession's journey, our collective narrative that spans across generations. I know a little bit about me being mentored because I have had some of the best. Tom Templin and Bonnie Blankenship at Purdue, Jim Ressler and Jim Wright at Paul Wright at Northern Illinois, Kim Graber and Amy Woods, my now colleagues at Illinois, and so many of you in this room are all among those who have helped me learn to do this job. You share in my successes. I would like to say a few words about Dr. Templin in particular. And I didn't know he was going to be here. No, absolutely not. He has always shown me what it means to be a caring and compassionate leader, something that he has done throughout his career. Whether it be working with doctoral students, mentoring early career faculty members, or providing leaderships to departments and schools, Dr. Templin has developed a reputation for leading with integrity. He listens to hear and understand rather than just to respond, cares deeply about the people with whom he works, and stands up for what is right even when it's difficult. If you attended Shape America, perhaps you had a chance to hear Dr. Templin talk about his approach to mentoring firsthand. While I was not there in person, I did have the pleasure of reading drafts of his speech before the conference. He continues to inspire me and motivate me to be better. Wes Wilson and I try to put what we both learned from Dr. Templin into action on a regular basis in how we approach working with the doctoral students we advise and mentor. It is my hope that all the students in the Pedagogical Kinesiology Lab at the University of Illinois feel valued, supported, and as if their needs are being heard and that they are held accountable in appropriate ways. We strive to create a culture in which they are positioned both as learners and contributors. After all, we all have something to learn from one another, and I have found great joy in learning from my students over the years. We also feel as if culture and inclusion are necessarily aspirational concepts. They are ever unfolding processes that need regular monitoring, not positions at which we arrive and rest comfortably. We tried to hold ourselves accountable for this idea in crafting a vision statement for our lab, which is displayed on our new website. The PKL strives to be an inclusive space where all individuals experience a sense of belonging and acceptance. Our scholarly activities not only advance knowledge, but also bring to the forefront the voices of individuals in our local and extended communities through the research process. In this way, our research is guided by an ethical responsibility to pursue a favorable future for individuals who do and do not experience disability across varied school and post-secondary contexts. I don't want any of my students to be me, neither in terms of my work habits or the specifics of what I study. I want them to be the best versions of themselves, to close the gap between the actual and an idealized self. Sure, we talk about theory and methods. We publish papers, and our lab makes scholarly advancements that we are proud to contribute. All of this matters, and I don't want to downplay it. To do so would seem disingenuous or unappreciative for the affordance that we have to do the work. These things, however, do not matter as much as being there alongside early career scholars as they grow, become independent thinkers, learn to express themselves in writing, find themselves, and find ways to contribute in the broader physical education system that are meaningful for them. There is something else here that I would like to explore. It's not enough for those of us who are mentors and who enjoy the privilege provided by tenure to simply elevate others. We also must use our positions to identify, question, and remove unnecessary roadblocks and barriers that we have had to overcome in our own journeys. Some of these things are programmatic and under our influence and control. Elements of our own academic career development that are no longer fit for the times should be questioned and challenged. Justification for the continued use of practices should be made not based on legacy, but on the continued need and use for that practice in contemporary times. I'm not advocating for reducing rigor, but that we act as humanists in considering the rationale and purpose for the decisions that we make in our roles as academic gatekeepers. Time for a moment of honesty. I'm much better at fitting in, helping to reproduce inherited cultures than I am as a change agent. We also know that entering existing cultures and seeking to create change can be challenging. It is risky for early career faculty members. I also believe that it is important to understand, I also understand and believe in the importance of growing with a collective before seeking to change it. All of this to say that questioning and challenging things is more aspirational for me. I believe an important part of the next phase of my academic journey will be finding ways to pave pathways and remove barriers for doctoral students and early career scholars. As one small example, I no longer require that doctoral student preliminary exams be completed in a locked room without access to resources, even though that was the format used in my own examination process. I find such processes to be archaic in a digital age where it would be arguably negligent to complete academic writing from memory and without the use of valuable resources. And to be fair, that wasn't Dr. Templin's decision. That was a program requirement. Beyond these more programmatic level challenges, there are also those more systematic and ingrained in our organizations and institutions. I have in mind equity needs and challenges. This is where social justice work becomes important. Higher education in general remains an inequitable space for women, people of color, those with disabilities, and numerous other marginalized groups. While these are big picture and systematic problems, we can do our part on a regular basis to ensure that our workspaces, research teams, and student groups are diverse and that the needs and interests of marginalized groups are considered actively. At the most fundamental level, this means holding ourselves and those around us accountable for acting in socially just ways. From the position of privilege that comes with tenure, we are empowered to challenge and deconstruct such issues. We should do so, even if doing it makes us uncomfortable or creates challenges in our relationships with colleagues. In addition to challenging existing inequities, we can also be more active in promoting a more diverse and socially just future for the discipline. Among other things, this includes being more intentional about recruiting future teachers and teacher educators who more accurately reflect the needs, interests, and backgrounds of the students they will teach someday. This equity agenda in service of educational and social justice is also an area that remains aspirational for me and that I believe will play an important role in the next season of my career. I have learned much over the last several years from social justice scholars, colleagues, and friends in the field that have helped me to develop an increasingly vocal advocate. I believe this has made its way into this speech and my writing, but less demonstrably into my practice. Fortunately, our field has a growing mass of scholars who apply critical theories and social justice frameworks to argue for more equitable spaces. Among other examples, Drs. Jen Watlin-Fassett and Sue Sutherland have done meaningful policy-focused work in Ohio that seeks to advocate for more socially just physical education. Dr. Kim Oliver has dedicated her career to understanding and better serving the needs and interests of girls and young women in physical education spaces. Dr. Samuel Hodge and Gerald Russell have intentionally sought out, recruited, and prepared faculty members of color who are now working at institutions across the country. Drs. Karen Goodreau and Victoria Shiver have begun creating such pathways for immigrants and first-generation Hispanic Americans in New Mexico. It would be remiss of me not to acknowledge the amazing panel hosted by Corey Dixon at our Invisible College. This work is here. It does not have to be our research specialization for us to learn from their scholarship and practice and leverage it to make our own spaces more socially just and inclusive. It does not need to be our research for us to recognize its value and advocate for its publication in scholarly journals. In fact, we scholars share the responsibility for doing our best to connect, integrate, apply, and improve the overall knowledge base in physical education and sport pedagogy. Science is a collective enterprise, not a collection of solo acts. To summarize at this stage, as we all move through our academic careers, achieve tenure, and advance towards positions as gatekeepers and disciplinary stewards, I would challenge us to do two things. First, be a mentor and a humanist. Help advance the careers of others in ways that are caring and put the betterment of the field ahead of personal success, accolades, or prestige. A rising tide lifts all ships, so do your part to lift up others. At the end of the day, remember that the people with whom we interact and the relationships we develop with them will be just as important to our legacy as our scholarly achievements, if not even more so. We will all experience challenges along our journeys, and those roads are better traveled with supportive companions inside and outside of the academy. We will have the opportunity to help others, and each of us will likely need support from time to time. This may mean that we get behind, miss deadlines, or otherwise feel as if we're disappointing ourselves and others. Give grace and a helping hand where you can. Second, with the privilege of tenure, use your position to do good and make the academy a better place for everyone. Deconstruct unreasonable and unfair practices, identify and critique injustices, and do your part to build a more diverse and socially just space. In some of these arenas, the pursuit of social justice may require that those of us with privilege be willing to compromise or relinquish some of the affordances which we have become comfortable. Such is often necessary in the pursuit of equity. I encourage us to embrace that, to see the importance of sacrifice in the process of pursuing justice. In thinking of the doctoral students and early career scholars in the room, more specifically, I am also reminded of how each of us must forge our own path. We all need to make decisions about the things in life and in the academy that matter to us. We need to decide how much of ourselves we are willing to invest in the work. At the end of the day, this needs to be your choice alone. Some of you may decide to take pathways similar to mine. It would be hypocritical for me to tell you not to. Still, I need to believe that it is possible to make a contribution in the preparation of future teachers, the improvement of programs and practices, and the scholarly literature without requiring that the work become your only identity. In other words, it's possible, even essential, to be a good friend, family member, parent, and community member while also being an academic. Balance in the management of the roles we play in our lives is essential to a healthy and a happy academy, because our personal lives always invade our professional ones and workspaces. I believe that now more than ever, and it is something for which I will advocate for others who pursue it. Relatedly, I would also tell you that interpersonal comparisons, while fueled through the culture of the academy, only breed insecurity, contempt, and fracturing within our system. I would encourage you to build bridges, care about and be advocates for one another, and remember that you too one day will hold the mantle of disciplinary stewardship. That is a responsibility that you will share with others who have similar career trajectories. You don't have to study the same things to appreciate one another's work. There is space for all of us. Learn from the mistakes and stand on the shoulders of the generations that precede you. Find your own way and take us to new heights. A favorable future for physical education will depend on it. As I angle towards closing, there's one last thing I wish I could tell 2010 Kevin. You are loved and you have value and worth. You were in 2010 and you are now in 2024. At times on this journey, you're not going to feel like it. You're going to feel alone, defeated, heartbroken, and scared. Sometimes before it gets better, the darkness will get bitter, bigger, but all of this will be temporary. That includes that feeling of rock bottom you will experience in the fall of 2021 when you move out and start over on your own. Despite how you will feel then, you have a lot of life to live and a lot of love to give. You will have bad days, but trust me when I tell you that this is not a bad life. People care about you, depend on you, and value you. You don't need to justify your existence by publishing papers. Do that because you enjoy writing. I know you do. Because you see your collective works as a narrative weaving an interactive story across journals and journal articles with other academics interested in topics that interest you. Because you enjoy contributing to this collective narrative while documenting what you learn, how you grow, and where you start to think differently. Just know your real worth comes through the relationships you form with others and the passion you bring to all ventures in your life, not just what you're paid to do. These things matter. You matter. Make no mistake about it, Kevin, you have a lot of work left to do, a lot of investment and growth. It's a lifelong process after all, but coming back to the present and talking to current Kevin, you're more confident, self-assured, and aware of who you are than you've ever been in your adult life. I wonder what you would have told your past self. All our lives are different, but I think it's necessary to look back, however short or long your academic career is, to acknowledge that we've all struggled and succeeded at times, but we are all successful. We are all gathered here as colleagues in one of the top research organizations in our field to share and listen to things that we are passionate about. We are all okay. In closing, there is one final idea I would like to leave you with. It spurs from one additional thing I remember from my first AERA conference in 2010 and other conferences I've attended over time. In thinking about senior colleagues with whom I've interacted much of my early career, it felt like many of them had it all together and just didn't make mistakes. Much of what they wrote and had to say seemed effortlessly sharp and intelligent, flawless. Like they just woke up in the morning, sat down behind a computer, and breezed through writing papers. It was something that I envied. Then I remember seeing Hans Vandermars present at an ASEP meeting several years ago when he acknowledged that the topic he was discussing was new and different for him, that he had worked a lot on what he was doing, and acknowledged that he still had room to grow and learn more. This was a turning point for me, to hear one of our disciplinary stewards explicate insecurity. I felt closer to Hans than I ever had before because I was given insight into his humanness. That idea of showing one another our humanness connects back to why I decided to approach the lecture in the way that I have. Over the past 3 years, I've learned a lot about myself and have grown a lot through some challenging times in my life. This has not been easy, but it's been valuable and important work, and I'm proud of the progress that I've made. I wanted to show you more of me, including some of the pieces that you might not get to see on a regular basis. My flaws, insecurities, fails, fears, longings, and hopes for the future. Among the things that the Academy tends to do is reduce us to our name, or perhaps our name and our conference personas. I think it's important that we show each other, especially those new members of the Academy, elements of the realness that resides within each of us. I can't speak for everyone, but I have a lot of realness in me. My students can tell you that I make mistakes every day. There is nothing perfect about me, and I don't have it together. Sometimes I feel like I'm actively falling apart. Still, I'm a tenured faculty member, and I love my job. It's not about being perfect. That's not what gets you to this podium that Kelly went and found for me. It's about doing your best to be human, owning your mistakes, giving back to the community, being curious, working with others in the pursuit of our curiosities, and striving towards a more socially just and equitable world. That is how you make the contributions to this community in ways that transcend your own scholarship and help us grow together. That is what matters, what forms our collective legacy. Thank you again to the committee for this incredible honor. I was a bit stunned when I was asked to give this year's Sig 93 Catherine Deanis Scholar Lecture. I was nominated by two of the field's most esteemed scholars, Steve Silverman and Hal Lawson, for whom I have immense respect and with whom I have enjoyed collaborating. Being asked to speak tonight has been one of the highest honors of my academic career, and is something that I have not taken lightly. In my efforts to be real, honest, and maybe a little provocative, I hope you can take something from my journey to help lift up others, choose to reach out a hand to support your colleagues, and make our community more just. Thank you.